All right. Well, tonight we're going to look at three books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And these are the books that conclude the historical books of the Bible as they're found in the present canonical order. And as I pointed out before, it's not that other books aren't historical, obviously. There are books of poetry that we'll get into, but the prophets and all those things are historical. But these are just known as the historical books because they trace the history of the nation from Joshua and the entrance into the land all the way through the monarchies, all the way to the Babylonian exile, and then to the return. And that's what we're looking at when we look at Ezra and Nehemiah. And then Esther happens in the context of Persia, the geographical context there. So we'll just do a quick overview of these three books. And then I've got something that I want to zero in on from Nehemiah. So actually, if you want to just get your Bible opened up to Nehemiah, that's where we'll pick up in the fourth chapter after we make it through the overview here. So, both Ezra and Nehemiah are devoted to the events occurring in the land of Israel at the time of the return from the captivity in Babylon. So, when we looked at Kings and Chronicles, those books take us up to the destruction of Jerusalem and the leading away of the people into captivity. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, was responsible for that. So they go into Babylon and they're there under judgment. God basically removes them from the land for 70 years. So after 70 years, he then allows them to come back into the land. He allows them to come back and rebuild the temple and restore the worship. He allows the city to be rebuilt. And those are the things that are happening in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. So they cover a period of approximately 100 years beginning in 538 BC. So the emphasis in Ezra is on the rebuilding of the temple. The temple was first rebuilt. So God sends them back. And yet, it's first the temple. The worship is restored. And the book of Ezra deals primarily with the restoration of the temple. And then in Nehemiah, which is later, it's the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah, maybe you've read through Nehemiah, you might remember in the early chapters, Nehemiah receives word that Jerusalem is a reproach. Even though many of the people have gone back, others have still remained, Nehemiah being one of them. He still remained back in the land of the captivity. And yet he gets word from Jerusalem that things have not gone well. In verse 3 it says, "The survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." So this is where Nehemiah is at. Now he's a cupbearer in the court of the Persian king. And so when he goes before the king one day looking downcast, the king asks him a question: "What's the matter?" And Nehemiah says, "The city of my fathers is lying in rubble." And he prays in his heart. He says, "Lord, you know, give me favor with the king. He wants to go back and he wants to rebuild Jerusalem. And so Artaxerxes gives him the permission to do that, and then the book records the things that happened when Nehemiah went back. Now, Esther records events that occurred when the Jews were captive in Persia under Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes, who reigned 486 through 465 BC. And this was that, the story of Esther really has to do with the deliverance of the Jews from an attempt to exterminate them by a wicked man named Haman. And Esther, who becomes the queen of Persia, is a young Jewish girl who's so beautiful she happens to get chosen to be the queen. And she then is able, because of her influence on her husband, she's able to save the Jews from this destruction. And so the theme there of the book of Esther, to a large degree, is the providence of God, how God is providentially working. The way God generally works in the lives of his people is through providence. And what providence means is that God is using a natural course of events to bring about his ultimate will and purpose in the lives of his people individually and in the lives of his people collectively. So Joseph's a great example of the providence of God. Through seemingly natural circumstances, God moves Joseph from Canaan to Egypt to ultimately be in power as the prime minister, but he uses these natural processes. His brothers are envious of him, they hate him, and they want to kill him, but one of his brothers says, no, that's not a good idea, let's not kill him, let's sell him. They threw him in a pit when the Ishmaelites came by, they sold him, and off he goes to slavery in Egypt. And there he is in the house of Potiphar. He's a slave, but he's actually promoted and he's doing pretty well. Then Potiphar's wife comes on to him, tries to seduce him. Joseph refuses that attempt. And she then turns around and says, he tried to rape me. So Joseph ends up in prison. But it's in prison that he meets the butler of Pharaoh. And the butler of Pharaoh is going to, a few years later, because Joseph interprets his dream, a few years later when Pharaoh has these dreams, the butler's going to say, I know a guy who can interpret those dreams. Oh, darn, I forgot to tell you about this guy, but when I was in jail, this guy interpreted my dream. Joseph comes before Pharaoh, tells him what his dream means. The next thing you know, Pharaoh says, you're the wisest man I've ever known. I want to appoint you over everything. But it was God's providence that brought him there. It was through all of these natural circumstances. And so likewise with Esther, it was the same sort of thing. It was through this beauty pageant. It was through her uncle saying, you know, you're very pretty. You ought to go and try out for the beauty pageant. It was through this natural course of events that she becomes the queen. But then at the critical moment, it's her word that saves the people. So providence is really the theme of the book of Esther. So in Nehemiah and Ezra, return of the remnant would be more or less the theme there. Now, key verses. As I've said, when it comes to the key verses, this is just, you know, this is me and my opinion. Other people would say, oh, no, there's another verse that's more key than that one. So that's okay. These are verses that I see as key verses. In the book of Ezra, chapter 7, verse 10, we read this. For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. So a key verse there. It's a key verse to me because it talks about this vitally important thing of preparing the heart to seek the law of God. So just for a moment, what does that mean, to prepare our hearts? How do we do that? He's going to prepare his heart to seek to understand the law so he can do it, and then he can teach it to other people. And of course, the first thing is that we need to do it, right? We've got to seek it out, then we've got to do it, and then we can pass it on to others. But what does it mean to prepare our hearts? We read in the last thing we were looking at with the kings there, that same phrase is used to some of the kings. They prepared their heart, or they did not prepare their heart. And so to prepare our hearts, I think it really means that we're just coming before the Lord. We're coming before him in prayer. We're coming before him in confession. We're coming before him in admission that we need him. We're coming before him and just waiting upon him. You know, today I was doing a run on the beach, and I was just thinking about what I'm teaching tonight, and I was thinking about this whole thing of preparing our hearts. And you know, I was thinking in my own mind, I was just thinking, man, you know, Lord, I want to have those times, you know, where I'm just sitting before you and I'm just worshiping you, and I'm, you know, I'm just there in your presence, just wanting to experience your touch and hear your voice. And you know, as I'm thinking about this, I'm also thinking, you know, it's funny how we can desire something and we can imagine it, and it seems so easy, but you know, when you try to do it, it's a whole different thing, isn't it? There's a battle. There's a battle with our own flesh. And the thing that got me thinking about it was this, because, you know, Cheryl and I have, for a long time, we've been taking walks. And over the years, as we've walked along the beaches, and mostly we do the beach, you know, we see people running by us all the time, you know, and, you know, you see people running by and you go, oh, that's nice. You know, they're running and, oh, that's neat. And, yeah, maybe I should run a little bit. And, you know, and, oh, yeah, well, you know, running, anybody can do that, you know. I'll tell you what, I have the greatest appreciation for runners right now. I just realize, and, you know, and I used to, I told Cheryl, you know, I used to see these guys, you know, they're kind of running like this. And of course, I would mock them and think, you know, look at those guys. What a joke. I told her the other day, I said, I will never mock a guy who's running like that again. Because that's how I run nowadays, you know. Just even lifting my legs is a major accomplishment. But my point is this. You look at somebody else doing something, and it looks so easy, doesn't it? And you just think, oh, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I'll jump out there. I'll just jump out there and run, you know. And yet you get out there and start to do it, and you find this is a whole nother, that's a whole nother issue here, actually doing it. You know, the same is kind of true with prayer and spiritual things. You can think about it. You can fantasize over it. You can kind of, you know, put yourself in that situation. I'm going to be seeking the Lord. But then you get up in the morning, and you feel like you were hit by a truck overnight, and you're cranky, and your mind isn't clear, and you're opening up your Bible going, oh, God, okay, Lord, here I am. But you know what you got to do? You got to do it. You got to press through it. You just got to get out there, just like running. You got to just get out there and do it, no matter how slow you start. No matter how slow we start in this preparation of our own hearts, we just have to do it. Because it's as we prepare our hearts to seek the word of the Lord, that's when we're going to be receiving that word for ourselves that we can do, and then that will give us authority when we are going to pass things on to others. We're speaking from experience. So that's what Ezra did. Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8. Here's a key verse here. So they read distinctly from the book of the law. They gave the sense and helped them understand the reading. This is describing what happened after they got the wall built and all the people gathered together. They brought out the book, the law, and it says they read distinctly from the book. They gave the sense and they helped people understand. This is the classic text in the Bible for what we do, which is known as exposition of the scriptures. We're reading the word, we're giving the sense, and helping people to understand how to apply it to their life. So it's a great verse because it's a verse that sort of lays out the way we are supposed to teach the Bible. And then in Esther 4:14, Here's the key verse from Esther. And this was the word that was given to Esther by her uncle Mordecai when she was hesitant to go to the king. Because if you went to the king and he didn't want you to come to him, he could execute you. So she was fearful to go to the king on behalf of her people. Her uncle is exhorting her to do it. And this is what he said to her. He said, "Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Mordecai says, "Look, Esther, this could be the very reason you are where you're at." And no doubt it was the very reason she was where she was at. She was there for this critical moment to save the people from annihilation. And so, easy application for us, the same thing is true. For such a time as this, it's no accident that we are living in the 21st century. It's no accident where we were born. It's no accident how we were brought up. It's no accident that we became followers of Jesus Christ. It's no accident that he's put us in strategic places. It's all part of God's providential plan to work out his will and purpose in and through our lives. And so we need to remember that. We need to keep that in mind. For such a time as this, we're right where God has placed us, and we want to seize the moment, and we don't want to miss the opportunities that he's going to bring our way. So, quick overview of these books, and just leave it at that with the key verses. But I want to take a few minutes, like I said, and I want to jump into Nehemiah here. And I just want to give you guys just some encouragement in regard to, you know, continuing to build the spiritual wall, so to speak, around your own life and the life of your family. This is what Nehemiah does. Of course, with the wall being broken down, everybody was highly vulnerable to being, harmed, harassed, whatever the case might be. So the wall needs to be rebuilt because the wall is a means of protection for the people because they're surrounded by enemies. We are building a wall, so to speak. And for some of you guys tonight, kind of like the situation then, you're rebuilding the wall. It was erected at one point, but because of foolishness on your part, because of bad decisions, because of mistakes, because of sins, the wall's been knocked down and all your defenses are gone and the enemy's been pummeling you and pummeling your family. But God's convicted you and he's spoken to you and he's dealt with you and he's turned you around, but you find yourself, you're having to rebuild the wall. And as you're rebuilding it, you're finding that it's not easy. And there are forces that don't want the wall rebuilt. And they are opposing you. So let's look at, with that in mind, let's look at what happens here with Nehemiah. Chapter 4. But so it happened when Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall. Listen to this. He was furious and very indignant. You know, Sanballat is a type of Satan. And when Satan saw you get on your knees and repent, when Satan saw you turn around and say, "Lord, I want to get right with you," he was furious about that. When Satan saw that new commitment that you've made to walk with the Lord and to be his servant, to be his witness, to influence your family, friends, co-workers, or whatever, it enraged him. Furious and very indignant. And what does it say about Sanballat? It says, and he mocked the Jews. And listen, this is a tactic of the devil. He will mock you. Listen to what Sanballat said. Verse 2, he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria, and he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes on it, he will break down their stone wall. And this is the exact same kind of thing the devil does. When we make a commitment to move forward with the Lord, he comes along and he mocks us. Oh, come on, you're going to do what? What do you mean you're going to follow the Lord? You know, you're such a flake, you're such a loser, you couldn't follow him in the past. What makes you think you're going to follow him now? And your efforts are going to be so feeble, you're never going to amount to anything. And he'll come along and he will try to discourage us from moving forward by mocking us. Oh, you're going to do something for God. Give me a break. Come on, what could you do for God? You don't have anything to offer to God. There's nothing that God would have you do for him. And he'll kind of just bring these accusations and these kinds of things. He'll hurl these things at our minds. Anybody ever experienced anything like that? Is it just me? Okay, good. I'm glad that there's some others here. This is what he does. This is the work of the enemy. And so he comes along with mockery. But look at verse 4, at what Nehemiah says. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to the land of captivity. So, what does Nehemiah do? He prays and he presses forward. Let's read on. Verse 7. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. And so the next thing is they threatened. First they mocked, and when the mockery didn't stop the Jews from rebuilding, then they started threatening them. Oh, if you keep it up, we're going to come and attack you. And this is what they said. They said, verse 11, our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. And so they come along with these threats. And listen, the enemy will come along and he'll threaten you. Oh, you know, if you really commit yourself to the Lord like that, you know what's going to happen? You're going to lose all your friends. You're going to lose your position at work. You might even lose your job. And you're going to be cut off from these associations. And even worse than that, you know, some calamity is going to befall you. Some evil thing is going to happen to you. The devil is a master at threatening evil consequences for obedience to God. He does that. He tries to get us afraid. He tries to get us to back down. We want to take a step forward. He says, oh, if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. A few years ago, we were doing an outreach to Brazil. And this was when my son was still here with us, I think. Oh, no, he was already gone. But he was going to be part of the outreach to Brazil. Anyway, we had to, get visas to go down. And everybody on the trip, like 20 people, 30 people, everybody got their visa. My son was the only one that got a visa that was stamped, no preaching or religious activity. He was going to Brazil to preach and to do ministry on the streets. So when I saw that in his visa, my first inclination as his dad was to say, hey, you can't go because I don't want you rotting in a Brazilian jail somewhere. And I really, it was this threatening sort of a thing. It's like, hey, they're going to be watching him. And the minute he gets on the streets with that guitar, the minute he starts talking about Jesus, they're going to be right there to bust him. And all of a sudden, there's all this, fear that's developing in me for my son. And of course, the Lord wouldn't let me succumb to it. The Lord just said, look, you got to trust me, put him in my hands. I'm going to take care of him, and you just leave this alone. And he never did end up in a Brazilian jail. He went down and did ministry and proclaimed the gospel on the streets, and God kept him safe. But this is what the enemy does. He threatens evil consequences for obedience to the Lord. Verse 9, though, nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them. So they prayed and they set a watch. Now, as we follow along in the story here, the next tactic is interesting. In verse 5, now look what happens. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now, the next thing, it says, and there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. So, the mocking didn't stop it. The threatenings didn't stop it. So now what's happening? There's a division that develops within the ranks themselves. And so now the Jews are divided up against each other. They're fighting. There's infighting. And of course, if anything's going to stop the work from moving forward, it's going to be infighting. This is what happens with Christians so often. You know, we end up bickering and squabbling with each other. And, it's crazy stuff. And it potentially could just put the brakes on everything that God's doing. But we can't succumb to that. We've got to rise above that and keep moving forward. But we've got to beware that this is the kind of thing the enemy does. And maybe even in your own personal situation, you find that, the people that you would think ought to be supporting you because you're trying to move forward in the Lord, they suddenly turn against you. They suddenly start fighting against you. They suddenly start opposing you. And you hear about this kind of stuff. I was talking to somebody the other day. They were telling me that, they're going through a time and they're, trying to really give themselves over to the Lord and seek the Lord. And the very person that encouraged them to come to the Lord in the first place is now turned around and just saying, you shouldn't be going to Bible college. You shouldn't be trying to learn the Bible. There's other things that you need to be doing with your life. And, there's a division and potentially just putting the brakes on everything. So we've got to beware of that. We've got to be on guard and we've got to do our best to put that stuff down when it comes up. So as we move on here, as we come into chapter 6. And so I've got 5 minutes to finish because my wife told me if I was not done by 8 o'clock, I was in big trouble. So so now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall and that there were no breaks left in it, though at the time I had not hung the doors and the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me harm. So I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down? Now, here's what's happening here. They're trying to intimidate Nehemiah now. They're saying, come on, we need to talk to you. I love his response. I'm doing a great work. I don't have time for that. I'm not going to bother with that. That response is it's a good response, and it's one that, a lot of times we need to use that response. I'm doing a great work. I've had things where, people have wanted me to do this, and they want to fight about that, and they want to argue with this. And, some guy a while back, he challenged me to a public debate, and I just said, I'm doing a great work. I don't have time to get into this petty theological debate with you as another Christian. What a ridiculous thing. So I'm doing a great work, not going to come down. They go on then, and they begin to slander Nehemiah, and they invent this whole thing that he's actually planning to become the king over the people. Verse 8, he says, then I sent to him saying, no such thing as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. This is what, the slander that will come. But verse 9, now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, and goes on, it says, he was an informer, he's a secret informer, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come and kill you. So here's this deceitful plotting, again, with the purpose of trying to get Nehemiah to stop the work out of fear. So this guy comes, he says, hey, listen, I've heard what they're saying, and they're going to kill you. You go in the temple and hide, so you'll be safe there. Look what he says in verse 11. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because of Tobiah and Sanballat. They had hired him. For this reason, he was hired that I should act, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so they might have cause for an evil report and that they might reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah, Sanballat, according to these their works, the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. So, again, just, you know, wanted to remind you that we're in a battle. And it's not going to go away. And so we've got to just hang in there and keep fighting. But, of course, we need to understand the tactics of our enemy. We need to understand, you know, how it is that he's working and what it is that he's using to try to get us to give up. That's the whole thing. Just give up. Don't try to serve the Lord. Don't try to do anything. Don't follow the Lord, he would say, even to that point. And it's a relentless thing, and I think that many would agree that are kind of, you know, been in the ministry for some time, that things have heated up and continue to heat up in a greater way than we've seen maybe in the past. And there's this constant thing that's going on, but Nehemiah becomes a great picture of a man who persevered. He trusted God. He stuck with the work. He was determined that God had appointed him to build the wall, so there was nothing that was going to prevent him from doing it, and he did it. He did it. He accomplished it. And you can do it because God's called you to do it, and he will strengthen you to do it. He'll equip you to do it. We just have to have that determination, basically, by the grace of God, we're going to do it.